This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There is an immediate need for humanitarian assistance to get into Khartoum and into Sudan as fast as possible.
That's former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under the Obama administration, Ambassador Johnny Carson, on Sudan's current deadly conflict. Details coming up. Also, the leaders of the Group of Seven Nations start their annual summit tomorrow. And Egypt is conducting national dialogue on the country's high priorities. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. In Sudan, hospitals and health facilities have struggled to keep operating since intense fighting broke out last month in Khartoum and rapidly spread to other parts of the country. A medical and surgical team from Doctors Without Borders, known as MSF, has started treating patients at Bashir Teaching Hospital on the south side of Khartoum as ongoing violence rapidly increases medical needs in the capital and elsewhere. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached the Will Harper, MSF Emergency Coordinator in Khartoum, to find out more.
Doctors Without Borders is currently working in South Khartoum. We're running a surgical and ER in the Bashir Teaching Hospital in South Khartoum. We arrived 2 weeks ago for a rapid assessment, and then we've been active treating cases and saving lives in this hospital for the past 10 days.
What type of patients are you getting? Are these bullet wounds? Or what type of patients do you have?
Doctors Without Borders, our team on the ground here working with the volunteers and staff here in the hospital, we're seeing, to put it simply, the impact of war, full stop. We're seeing gunshot wounds, victims of bomb blasts, shelling. We're also seeing the surgical needs that exist in a city the size of Khartoum, traffic accidents and things impacting civilian life daily. Our first day of intervention, we saw 60 gunshot wounds come through the hospital. My team last night was in the operating theater until 5 a.m. So the needs are pretty enormous, and the number of cases coming through, traumatic injuries, complex surgeries, and then also just the post-operative care, treating patients to control infection and be able to insist on a good outcome is a real challenge for us.
How secure is your facility since the fighting is still ongoing?
That's a good question. The Bashir Teaching Hospital is in Khartoum City, in South Khartoum. It's an area that we selected. We had access to. People have access to the hospital, but we're on the zone. I mean, we hear the bombs dropping even now. If the speaker can pick it, the gunshots and smoke rising from the city of Khartoum, where the active fighting is. So we needed to be in a hospital that is close enough to the front line, close enough to the conflict to have an impact, to save those lives in that time it takes for people to get to us. But we also need to be in a place that keeps our staff safe and that patients are comfortable to be here. So we're really trying to find that zone in between, and this is where we've set up operations for now.
I understand you're working with the local doctors as well. Are these government employees? What type of doctors are you working with?
Yeah, it's a real mix of people that are supporting this hospital. So Doctors Without Borders, working with volunteers from the community, from the local area, as well as doctors, nurses, medical staff who have volunteered their time, Sudanese healthcare workers that are also committed to this, to making this hospital functioning. So this hospital was completely non-functional. Volunteer initiative started it, and then we've come in to really bring that extra surgical capacity, bringing in international staff, supplies, and a bit of extra on top to really make this into a functioning surgical referral center. So we have a long way to go, but the hospital is open 24/7. We're seeing patients coming in from quite far away, even other areas of the city, as the word spreads that Doctors Without Borders is here to provide free healthcare to anyone who can access this hospital. And I think that's really a piece of this that we're trying to, beyond the medical care, it's that humanitarian imperative and to create a space that's neutral, impartial, insisting on our humanitarian principles and providing quality free healthcare in a war zone. That's what this whole project is about.
Given the enormity of the work you're doing there and the people who are in dire stress, How do you get your supplies? Do you have enough supplies to cope with the task at hand?
The supply question is a big one, and the short answer is not yet. We are bringing in supplies that we had in the country. MSF Belgium, we had a warehouse about 10 or 15 minutes away that we were able to access and pull some supplies from. We've gotten supply from some of the other MSF sections, the Doctors Without Borders sections, MOH supply, and we just landed yesterday a cargo plane with almost 30 tons of medical supply into Port Sudan that's on the road traveling towards Khartoum as we speak. So the supplies are coming in. We need more support with that. We as Doctors Without Borders have lost supply as well due to looting and theft. Some of the warehouses have been broken into. So all of those impacts of the conflict are impacting our ability to provide healthcare. Fuel is another question. The electric power grid is inconsistent at best. And of course, we can't have a power outage during an operation. So procuring diesel fuel and clean water just to keep this hospital running adds to the challenges beyond the medical work.
That was Will Harper, MSF Emergency Coordinator in Khartoum. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from Khartoum. Also, the United Nations says more than half of Sudan's population now needs aid and protection. Civilians are seeking shelter from airstrikes and sporadic clashes that continue between rival military factions in the Khartoum area. Residents say power has been cut, food is in short supply, and drinking water is scarce due to the violent power struggle now in its second month, despite international mediation efforts. Ambassador Johnny Carson was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under the Obama administration and currently is the senior advisor at the Albright Stone Bridge Group at the United States Institution of Peace. He tells me no one expected what is currently happening in Sudan.
Situation in Sudan is tragic and horrible for all the people of that country, but especially the people in the capital city of Khartoum. I think no one expected the kind of conflict that has emerged over the last 3.5 weeks that has left that city partially destroyed and hundreds of thousands of people homeless and on the move. There is an immediate need for humanitarian assistance to get into Khartoum and into Sudan as fast as possible. Everyone who has an opportunity as a nation or a government to help address the humanitarian situation should do so. I know there are ongoing efforts to try to broker another ceasefire, but it is imperative that pressure be put on all of the parties to engage in a cessation of hostility, to allow humanitarian aid and assistance to get into that country. The movement of peoples not only undermines the stability inside of Sudan, but it has a huge impact on all of the neighboring countries that are receiving refugees from that tragic situation.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said last Monday regarding American citizens in Sudan, since you were like the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, American citizens in Sudan have told the U.S. government that they want to leave, but the State Department is providing them with advice and guidance, but there are still no plans to offer them transportation because it is too dangerous, according to Mr. Blinken. And there is an estimated 16,000 Americans in Sudan, many of them dual nationals. So what is the policy of the United States in situations like this?
The United States tends to do as best it can to stay in contact with American citizens. Consular sections routinely send out messages to citizens in a country. The consular section is closed, but I think neighboring countries and the U.S. government are, in fact, trying to maintain contact with U.S. citizens who are currently in Sudan. There were several efforts, as I understand it, by the U.S. government to arrange for those Sudanese American citizens who wanted to leave the country to do so. But the situation on the ground is dangerous, but I think the U.S. government is continuing to try to maintain email contact with those individuals, giving them information as best it can on how they might be able to leave the country. Warnings were issued, I think, very clearly over the last several weeks, encouraging American citizens, dual nationals, to leave the country. And there were several convoys that were arranged by the State Department for individuals to leave the country. Situation is dangerous, but it is the responsibility of those citizens to take care of themselves, to look out after themselves. But it is a dangerous situation. I think there's still an ongoing effort to try to provide those individuals with information on how they might be able to leave the country.
That's former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Johnny Carson. He talked with me from Washington. United States Ambassador Ruben Brigitte has said South Africa's government secretly exported weapons to Russia. President Cyril Ramaphosa immediately denied the allegation last week and pledged to establish an independent inquiry to investigate it. One analyst with knowledge of South Africa's arms sector says it is unlikely that Pretoria sold arms to Russia.
According to U.S. intelligence reports, the sanctioned Russian ship, Lady R, was loaded with weapons at a South African naval base near Cape Town in December. Brigitte's comments at a news conference in Pretoria reverberated around the world.
The arming of Russia by South Africa with the vessel that landed in Simonstown is fundamentally unacceptable. We are confident that weapons were loaded onto that vessel, and I would bet my life on the accuracy of that assertion.
The governing African National Congress, the ANC, insists it's neutral in the war in Ukraine, but its officials have been visiting Moscow since President Vladimir Putin's invasion. This week, South Africa's top army general was there to discuss military cooperation with his Russian counterpart. Documentation from South Africa's Ministry of Defense says the Lady R docked in Simonstown to deliver 5 million rounds of ammunition for the Army's Special Forces. A report from South Africa's Arms Control Committee reflects that the ammunition was ordered in 2019. Russia is the second largest exporter of arms in the world. Professor Guy Lam of Stellenbosch University's Political Science Department says the optics don't look good for South Africa, but he doubts the country sold weapons to Russia.
South Africa doesn't have a massive arms manufacturing capacity, and when it comes to conventional ammunition, it's quite limited. So the question is, why would Russia deliver a large consignment of ammunition to South Africa and then take back ammunition from us to Ukraine?
Lam is a former arms trafficking investigator for the United Nations. He has researched the arms trade and arms control in Africa for 20 years.
It's not likely that we saw a significant shipment of arms and ammunition put on board this particular vessel because government didn't provide a permit. They've indicated that. There would have had to have been all sorts of bribes and skullduggery and, you know, kind of overt types of operations to do this. It wouldn't have been in the industry's interest because the industry depends on a range of other countries to export arms to. It wasn't in government's interest because the likelihood of being exposed, and it would have certainly resulted in a lot of tension and negative consequences in terms of trade for South Africa.
But Brigitte's allegations alone have ratcheted up the tension between Pretoria and Washington, largely based on overt support in the ANC for Putin. Lam has called on the Biden administration to release the intelligence on which the ambassador's claims were based.
Intelligence reports always need to be kind of challenged and scrutinized because they have been used. I mean, if we look, for example, the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 was on the basis of an intelligence report that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and that proved to be fraudulent. The report might be accurate, but it's not being put in the public domain. They're saying they'll give it to the Commission of Inquiry, but haven't indicated when that would happen. So it ultimately comes down to this intelligence report.
Lam says Brigitte would not have gone public with such serious allegations without getting the go-ahead from Washington. But he says the ambassador's claims are going to be very difficult to prove, unless the American intelligence dossier contains clear evidence such as photographs and video footage. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The leaders of the Group of Seven Nations arrived in Hiroshima, Japan today for their annual summit. Among other issues, they will weigh tighter sanctions on Russia and protections against what some consider China's economic coercion as well as its human rights record. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is hosting leaders from six other wealthy democracies in his hometown, a city synonymous with nuclear destruction and home to several peace monuments. Leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, will try over 3 days to forge a united front on Russia and China, where the allies' interests do not always neatly align. Jennifer King with the Associated Press has more.
President Biden greeted troops and Japanese officials at a hangar at a Marine Corps Air Base near Hiroshima before heading to a meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida.
The bottom line, Mr. Prime Minister, is that when our countries stand together, we stand stronger.
White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says the two leaders have a lot to talk about ahead of the larger Group of Seven summit.
The military dimension of the alliance, the economic dimension, the recently concluded agreement on clean energy, the work we're doing together on economic security. This alliance, I think, is in a genuine high watermark.
The president's cutting his trip short in hopes of finalizing a deal to raise the government's debt limit. White House staff who've been negotiating with Congress will be along for the trip and be part of the team updating the president on the status of the talks. I'm Jennifer King.
The full summit kicks off tomorrow and concludes on Sunday. Immediately afterwards, President Biden heads back to Washington, canceling his plans to visit Papua New Guinea and Australia. Instead, he will focus on the debt limit talks with members of the U.S. Congress. The Russian media crackdown that followed its invasion of Ukraine has made it more difficult for people outside the country to know what Russians think about the war. Reporter Genia Dalet met some Russian tourists in Egypt who described how their lives have changed.
Scuba diving instructor Tamara Taratorina says business has been down since the invasion of Ukraine, when sanctions cut Russians' access to credit cards and stopped international flights. The St. Petersburg-based tour operator says she canceled many trips before bringing this group of divers to Egypt.
This year, it is very difficult to persuade somebody to go on vacation. Ticket prices have doubled. Well, at least now there are flights available. And second, in the fall, we had a wave of mobilization, and many men left Russia. And now a vacation is on the very bottom of their priority list as they try to figure out how to feed their families back in Russia.
Freight hauler Roman Gavrilov says sanctions have made it harder to buy European cargo trucks, so now he's looking at Chinese markets that remain open for Russian business.
Since the currency rate of the Russian ruble hasn't changed much in respect to the U.S. dollar, we're also making more than twice as much as before. It happened because all foreign transportation companies left Russia, and we have a big demand. So this way we keep the money within the family, so to speak. Everyone wins.
The war has brought new Russian laws prohibiting anti-war statements or calls for international sanctions against the country. Viktor Chepozhov is a Moscow diving instructor.
You can be punished for a wrongly said phrase or an imprecisely expressed thought or a thought that contradicts some current principles. Mainly, the people who disagree would discuss it in their own kitchen. There is no open public discussion when it comes to the topic of the special military operation in Ukraine.
Diver Alexei Mitrohin is from the city of Voronezh, less than 300 kilometers from the Ukraine border. He says during a war, people should not criticize their government.
I believe you should support your government in these times. Even if you disagree, you can express your opinion after everything is over.
These Russian tourists agreed on one thing. They all empathize with people on both sides who lost loved ones and want the war to end. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Hurghada, Egypt.
Egypt's national dialogue has begun 3 days a week. This week's discussions focused on the electoral system for the House of Representatives, economic issues, and some human rights issues. Some government critics say the tightly controlled national dialogue may leave room for minor economic reforms, but it is unlikely to generate the serious political changes that people are increasingly demanding. Mohamed Anwar Sadat, president of the Egyptian Liberal Party of the Reform and Development, talks with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about where President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi needs this national dialogue to fix the political and economic problems.
Well, honestly, he doesn't need. If there is a will, I think he can do it. But fine, let's see if he would like to make a big shift in his policies and he would like to have it as an outcome of a national dialogue. Fine. For me, the most important is that it happened, whether it comes from him personally or it comes out of this dialogue, fine. I don't care. The most important is we would like to live in peace and stable and opportunities for us is what I would like to see happening.
The recommendations of the National Dialogue Committees in Egypt will be submitted to the president himself, who will then decide what to accept or what to reject. Only afterward will they be debated in the parliament with expected approvals. You were a veteran member of the Egyptian parliament. Does the existence of such a process illustrate more than anything the total powerlessness of the Egyptian parliament?
Well, as we all know, following the performance of the parliament, of course, they don't have full authority to deal with many things. We haven't seen any kind of a real questioning or accountability to the government or confidence vote. We haven't seen this, but the way I see it is that there is some independent voices in the parliament whom I think they can speak the truth and whom they are willing to support all what we believe should happen in this country. So I believe if President Sisi will consider whatever the recommendation come out of this dialogue or the advisory board, I think if it's passed to the government for executive orders or to the parliament for amending legislations or having a new legislations, I think the parliament will consider and they will act and it will be somehow having a big chance to be adopted. This is my impression. I think the president, the government, they have come to an understanding that time have come, that there has to be a change in the policies. Somehow they should show some flexibility and they should give up these exceptional measures they used to have during the last couple of years because there is no justification for any exceptional measures. The country is more or less stable, peaceful. There is no threats, terrorists. So if we are facing such a severe economic and financial problem, the only way is to bring people together so they can be more productive, they can be more united. This is the only way out. And I hope that this is already in the mind of the president and all the government.
President of the Egyptian Liberal Party for Reform and Development, Mohamed Anwar Sadat, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Iyabaro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.